I am also military caste, my lord. So you are, the prince sighed, then turned back to the door. I'll tell your family that you died bravely, protecting me from an assassin. They'll not be harmed. Thank you, my lord. Farewell, Nias. I'm sorry. So am I, my lord. The prince left. After a moment, the Reaper came. Chapter 8. A gatherer shall seek purity within the Hetua, keep hidden among the faithful, and reveal his whole self only to the recipient of Hananja's blessing. Wisdom. A leaf had fallen into the fountain. The patter of water against its surface sounded like rain. Eiru closed his eyes as he sat on the fountain's edge, listening. Rain came only once a year in Gujahara, during the spring. When it came, the goddess's blood overflowed her banks and flooded the entire river valley, from the Sea of Glory all the way into the northeastern reaches of Kiswa. Most Gujarin hated flood season, and the small discomforts that it brought, mud everywhere, insects rampant, families forced to live on their upper floors or rooftops until the waters receded. Eiru had always loved flood season himself. It cleansed, despite the initial mess. The city's sun-baked walls gleamed anew once the dust of the dry seasons had been washed away. It renewed, for without the annual floods, Gujara's narrow band of fertile land would be swiftly devoured by the deserts beyond. The boy would make a fine replacement once his training was complete, Eiru decided. But Najiri was to replace Unaune. He grimaced, remembering this. There were one or two other promising youngsters among the acolytes who might replace Eiru himself. None so clearly called to the task as Najiri had been, but suitable nevertheless. Life would be difficult for Santayi and Rabana until the new gatherers gained seasoning, but soon their younger brethren would be ready to walk the goddess's most difficult path. Then the gatherers of Hananja would be renewed, cleansed at last of weakness and taint. Eiru, brother! The patter of the fountain might have covered the boy's footsteps, but not the rustling of the palm fronds. These were so thick in the water garden as to be unavoidable. Yet Najiri had approached undetected. Eiru smiled to himself in approval. Hananja has given us to each other, Najiri. He kept his voice only loud enough to be heard over the fountain. In the intermittent silence he heard the boy's soft intake of breath. Me to you in your time of need. Now you to me. I will be here until you need me no longer. Understand this. More silence, just for a moment. I may need you for many years yet, Eiru brother. Not so long. Only until your apprenticeship ends. And beyond. Eiru turned away from the fountain and looked at him, surprised by the urgency in the boy's tone. Najiri stood a few feet away, half hidden amid the palm tree shadows, looking every inch the handsome young high caste in a tailored shirt and loin skirt of fine woven cloth. No one would guess him servant caste given his manner and his beauty. There was something perpetually deceptive about him. Fine bones hid the strength that came from years of physical training, and his smooth-cheeked, pretty face drew attention away from his eyes, which Eiru knew could turn very cold when circumstances merited. He had always had gatherer's eyes, even as a child. Not now, though. Now Najiri's face seemed calm, but his body was rigid, betraying feelings that perhaps even he did not yet fully understand. I should never have allowed you to choose me as your mentor. Selfish of me, and confusing to you. Poor child. A gatherer must be strong enough to stand alone, Najiri, Eiru said. The boy's face twitched ever so subtly at this warning. Eiru could not guess what was in his mind. Your greatest lessons will come long after your apprenticeship, taught to you by the world. I cannot stand between you and those. I know that, brother. There was an edge to Najiri's voice all of a sudden that Ehuru had not expected. I went with you all those years ago because I had already grown to understand it. You taught me my first lesson, that love means sacrifice, making choices that are good for others, even at the cost of the self. He ducked his eyes suddenly, radiating unhappiness. I can do that, but I see no reason to do it unnecessarily. Suddenly, Ehuru wanted to embrace him. It was the wrong thing to do, too familiar, too paternal. Najiri was his path-brother, not his son. Some day soon his opinions would hold as much weight as Ehuru's own. The relationship between mentor and apprentice required a careful balancing of affection, with respect on both sides. But in the wake of his mishandling of the Bromarte soul and the miserable self-loathing he had wrestled in the days since, it was both humbling and humiliating to realize that Najiri still thought highly of him. Humiliating because he did not deserve the boy's admiration, but humbling to realize he could not abandon his duty so easily. The boy trusted him, needed him. He had to be worthy of that trust, become worthy of it somehow, and stay worthy for long enough to get the boy trained. A heavy burden, this unwanted reason to live. Yet in his innermost heart, he could not lie to himself. It was a relief as well. The superior had been right to require this of him. We have duties to complete, Ehuru said at last, and after a moment the boy took a deep breath to compose himself, then nodded. A fine replacement indeed, in spirit, if not truth. Ehuru turned and led the boy out of the water garden. They stopped in the silent, dim hall of blessings to kneel at Hananja's feet, where they asked her to divert a fraction of her attention from the eternal dream long enough to guide their endeavor. Then they left the Hedewa by the gatherer's gate and went out into the night. Ehuru had chosen not to travel the streets or rooftops this time. The hour was still early. Too many of the city's folk were abroad seeking entertainments or working now that the day's heat had faded. Ehuru and Najiri had both disguised themselves as wealthy high castes, so they traveled as high castes would, hiring a small carriage drawn by a strong young man of the servant caste. With Hedewa provided funds, Ehuru paid the servant to take them directly to the bronze gates of Yonaeon. At the palace, other carriages had arrived to dispense passengers, and a number of waiting guests milled about the gates and courtyard. Most of them wore the rich colors and silks of foreigners, dignitaries in town for Hamyan night, and all of them chattered loudly of the sights they'd seen and the pleasures they'd tasted, and how marvelous was the prince's hospitality. Ehuru had chosen to disguise himself as a wealthy shunha, which allowed him to glide through the crowd in haughty silence. Shunha's scorn for foreigners was infamous. None of the guests even tried to speak to them. He drew Najiri along in his wake, as if the boy were a servant or favorite, and was pleased to see that Najiri played along perfectly, keeping silent with his eyes downcast. The guises were so suitable that the gate guards waved them through without a second glance, until Ehuru paused to flash the Hedewa token concealed in the palm of his cupped hand. The guard who saw it stiffened and looked up at them for a moment, then jerked his head again to send them through. Word would spread, Ehuru knew, first through the guards, then the servants and low castes. By dawn, even the royals would know that a gatherer had been in the palace on Hedewa business. Thus, no one would suspect rivals or criminals when the body was found in the morning, and the guards would not be accused of laxity. Hananja's law was paramount, but that did not prohibit her servants from showing professional courtesy. Once within, Ehuru led the way up stairwells and through a labyrinth of curving corridors, seeking the halls designated for guests. He did not hurry, for Shunha never hurried. The guards eyed but did not question them, and Ahuru did not bother to inform them of his true identity. He had satisfied practicality. Now duty took precedence. The guest halls were lined with thickly curtained entryways, each leading into an identical furnished apartment. The higher floors held even finer accommodations and their target, but this floor was the means they would use to reach her. There were 8 apartments here, 2 of which were dark and silent. Selecting the first of these, Ahuru pushed the curtain aside without jingling any of the tiny bells sewn along its bottom edge and entered. He held himself tense in case the chamber was occupied, but the rooms had a disused and impersonal air. Moonlight filtering through the sheer balcony curtain outlined brocaded cushions and plush couches, allowing them to navigate easily in the dark. Ahuru lit a single candle, while Najiri looked around, his face expressionless, even though Ahuru knew the boy had rarely seen such opulence. "The floors above us are for the lowest ranked of the royal family, and the highest ranked of the guests," Ahuru said. "With the palace so full of strangers tonight, the guard will concentrate its efforts on protecting the prince, wherever he happens to be. That leaves all other areas, like this floor, vulnerable." He began to undress, laying aside the rich garments and jewelry of his costume. The tithe-bearer should be in one of the suites on the next floor up. Najiri noted Ahuru's preparations and began to remove his own high-caste disguise. The boy had applied a cosmetic balm under his clothing, Ahuru saw with approval. The brown pigment would help to dim his conspicuously pale skin. "Do we know which suite?" Najiri asked, all business. "The Kisawati ambassadorial suite is right above this room." I see, Ahuru brother." In the midst of donning his ornaments, Najiri fumbled the jungisa, his own, newly issued and carved in the likeness of a dragonfly. Ahuru winced, but the boy stooped and caught the precious stone before it could hit the floor. He straightened and attached it properly this time, shoulders hunching in shame. Ahuru watched him. A degree of nervousness was understandable, but if Najiri could not be calm, he would have to remain behind while Ahuru went up to perform the gathering. Either sensing Ahuru's scrutiny, or realizing the problem himself, Najiri drew himself upright and moved to sit on a nearby couch. His eyes closed, his lips moved in prayer. Presently the wire-taut tension went out of his frame. Pleased, Ahuru went to the balcony. Yanya Eon's courtyard spread below, empty save for sand that had been swept into decorative patterns, and the sun pavilion. No sign of the previous night's revelry lingered to spoil the image of perfect peace. It was a view so familiar that for a moment his mind wandered away from duty, remembering the other life of his childhood. He had visited Yanya Eon only a handful of times, yet every visit was clear as water in his memory. In those days, gatherers had been nothing more than shadowy figures from his mother's tales, and the then-prince had been more of a god to him than Hananja. Movement across his field of vision caught his eye. He looked up to see a shadow fly across the bands of the dreaming moon. A skyrer, one of the night-hunting birds of the desert. They rarely hunted in the river valley itself, preferring the borderlands near the desert, where there were scrub mice and lizards in plenty. Those of the farming caste considered it an ill omen to see skyrers over inhabited land outside of the rainy season, a sign that something, somewhere, was out of balance. A predator's silhouette etched upon a moonlit rooftop. Behind him, Najiri finished his prayer. "Brother, forgive me for the delay." Ahuru closed his eyes and listened. The dreamer had risen fully, an immense four-hued eye filling the night sky. He could taste the subtle change in the air as people sought their beds and beasts settled in their stalls. Closer by, faint sounds from the other guest suites had ceased. For a moment he thought he heard whispers on the wind, a vision. understandable, given the length of time since his last gathering, and unimportant. He exerted his will, and the illusion faded. All was still. "Time," he said, and Najiri drew close behind him. It was a simple matter to stand on the railing and reach up to the ledge above, but he moved carefully anyhow. There were surely guards a few balconies up, protecting the prince's quarters. Levering himself up, he settled in a crouch on his hands and toes and peered at the balcony hanging, while Najiri swung up to join him. The chamber beyond was dark. The faintest hint of fragrance wafted out to him as a breeze stirred the silk, a woman's perfume. Najiri's bare feet patted against the stone as he landed on the balcony. Ehru glanced at him and saw that the boy's face was calm, focused. Excellent. Another breeze flickered past, causing the hanging to billow gently outward. Ehru flicked it to widen the opening further and slipped within, pausing against a nearby wall to allow his eyes to adjust to the darkness. Najiri did the same, both of them rising to a half-crouch. Moving away from the wall, they picked their way among the furnishings. Past the main chamber lay the bedroom. A set of wooden chimes swayed in the window, occasionally emitting random hollow notes. He heard a rustle and murmur from the bed. She slept restlessly. Only one breather, she slept alone. He signaled Najiri with a nod, and together they approached the bed. Too late, Ehuru heard the whisper of movement that the woman's stirrings had covered, shifting cloth, a careful step. In the same moment he heard the forceful release of a held breath and felt its warmth tickle the hairs on his right arm. He reacted without thinking, throwing himself forward just as something cold and sharp grazed his back, leaving a thin thread of fire along his skin. Najiri's blurt, "Brother!" broke the silence. Ehuru abandoned stealth as he sensed his attacker closing in. Off balance, he caught himself against the edge of the bed and kicked out. His foot struck flesh and shoved something backward. He heard a muffled curse and garlic-tinged breath wafted past his face. In the bed, the woman jerked upright, gasping. Then Najiri lunged past him, a blurred silhouette batting and shoving at another silhouette half his size. Something gleamed brighter against the shadows, a knife, poised to stab Najiri's side. Ehuru struck first, his fist meeting bone. The knife clattered to the floor. In the same instant, Najiri made some sort of sharp movement, and the smaller silhouette fell against the bedroom hanging, ripping it in a loud snarl of cloth. Najiri closed in swiftly. Lantern light flared, painful in the dimness, and shocked them all to stillness. "What in the names of the thousand sunspawn is going on here?" demanded the woman. Chapter 9. A gatherer shall enter buildings in concealment and approach the bearer of the goddess's tithe in stealth. Thus is peace maintained into dreaming. Law. For several seconds after being jolted out of sleep, Sunandi could not comprehend the tableau before her. Lin lay on the floor, coughing and clutching at her throat. A slim, pale Gujarine youth, not far past the age of adulthood, crouched over her in a striking stance, staring at Sunandi in almost comical surprise. Another man, bigger, older, dark as a Kisawati and somehow familiar, stood in the foreground, half-turned to her, his eyes wide with shock and anger. Then the fog of sleep lifted and details struck. Lin's knife on the floor, the intruder's black-dyed clothing, a moon-tier embossed ornament on the man's nearer hip, the emblem of the Hetawa. Dearest dreamer, Nias had been right. "Nandi!" Lin's croak startled her out of shock. She threw aside the sheet, heedless of her own near nudity. She wore only a light shift, and reached beneath the pillow to pull out the dagger she kept there. She snatched it from its sheath and leaped to her feet. "Get away from her!" The man tensed as if to fight, and then some unidentifiable shadow crossed his face, replacing the anger with a strange, somehow detached calm. He straightened, and then, shocking Sunandi nearly out of her skin, went down on one knee in formal manuflection. "Forgive me. This should have gone peacefully." The man's voice was deep and so soft that she strained to hear him. He flicked some signal at the youth. The youth took Lin by the arm to help her up. Lin jerked her arm free and stumbled back to glare at both of the strangers. Her breath still wheezed alarmingly through her throat, though she seemed to be recovering. Sunandi edged over to her, knife still at the ready. With her free hand, she pulled Lin's hand away from her throat. An angry red mark spread across the girl's larynx. "I did not strike to kill," the youth said, almost apologetically. He too was soft-spoken, though his voice was higher pitched. "I meant only to silence her." "Najiri," the man said, and the youth fell silent. Reaction set in as Sunandi's fear eased, though anger replaced it. She shivered uncontrollably as she stepped around the bed, pulling Lin with her to put some distance between them and the strangers. The killers. "Is this the piety of Gujara?" she demanded. Her voice sounded harsh and loud compared to theirs. "I was told the gatherers of Hananja had honor. I never dreamed you would allow yourselves to be used like this." The man flinched suddenly as if her words had been a blow. "Used? Yes, damn you, used! Why even bother pretending to serve Hananja's law? Why delay? Kill me and be done with it, unless you mean to talk me to death."
"Nandi,"
Lin's voice was a hoarse whisper. It was not the wisest thing to say, true, but something in her words had jarred the older one. She had to keep talking. He was the greater danger, she saw at once, not just physically. There was something else about him that set her nerves a-jangle every time their eyes met. "Perhaps the fact that he wants to kill me." The gatherer went still. His hand drifted away from his side, the fingers curling in an odd gesture. First and middle fingers forked, the rest folded neatly out of the way. For some reason, that gesture sent a chill prickling along Sunandi's skin. "I was trying to put you at ease," he said, "but I can calm you once you're asleep, if you prefer."
"Gods, no!"
She took an involuntary step back. He did not lower his hand. "Explain your statement, then," he said. The youth frowned at him in sudden surprise. "That we are being used."
"Are you mad? Get out before I shout for the guards. You're the worst assassins I've ever seen."
"We are not assassins."
"You are.
Doing it in the name of your bloodthirsty goddess changes nothing. Are you the one who's been killing the prisoners? Did you kill Kingja, too?" The man's face changed subtly. Still calm, but no longer detached. She thought she read anger in his eyes. "I have never gathered anyone named Kingja," he said. He began to pace around the bed, every step silent, his eyes never leaving hers. The youth followed him, less gracefully, but with the same soundless menace. "No one I have ever gathered has been imprisoned, except within his own suffering flesh or blighted mind. I offer her peace in exchange for pain, fear, hatred, loneliness. Death is a gift to those who suffer in life." He stopped, breaking the spell of voice and movement, and with sudden, chilling clarity, Sunandi saw that the gatherer had closed the distance between them until he stood only a few feet away. His hand was still poised in that odd gesture. This time he meant to strike. And when he did, no knife or half-grown bodyguard would stop him. The fear spiked into terror, and then receded as Kinja's training reverberated through her mind. 2 days ago, I saw a corpse, she said. The gatherer paused. A man who had died in his sleep some while before. His face. I have never seen such anguish, gatherer. In Kiswa, we tell tales of your kind. You priests who bring dreams of death. They say the dreams are not always pleasant. They say that sometimes, if one of your kind loses control, the victim dies Irusham, wearing the mask of horror. Do you still want to tell me you know nothing of that? The gatherer froze, the deadly intent in his eyes giving way to something unreadable. I know of it, he said, barely louder than a whisper. Then do you truly expect me to believe, she said, softening her own voice, that you arrive here to kill me, not even a 4 day later, and it has nothing to do with the prince's plans for war? The gatherer frowned, and she realized she'd made an incorrect assumption somewhere. There was no mistaking the confusion on his face. Just then the youth stepped forward, apparently unable to keep silent. He did not quite step in front of the man, but his stance radiated protectiveness. The prince has nothing to do with who is gathered or why, the youth said. And my brother's mistake has nothing to do with any war. Brother? Ah, yes. The boy was the man's physical opposite. It was unlikely they were related. He had to be the man's apprentice. Snippets of gossip overheard at the Hamyan merged with the niggling sense of familiarity, and abruptly she knew who the man was. You are Ehiru, she said, the prince's last surviving brother. The gatherer's eyes narrowed. Yes, that was it. Each man had clearly taken after his respective mother in most ways, but the stamp of the shared sire was in their eyes. Ehiru's were an onyx version of the prince's, just as lovely, though far, far colder. My family is the Hetwa, the gatherer snapped. But before that, you were of the sunset. Your mother was Kiswati, a Shunha noblewoman, probably some kin of mine. She gave you to the Hetwa to save your life. The gatherer scowled. Irrelevant. Once the Hetwa accepted me, I became wholly theirs. The prince has no brothers. I have 1,000. If this was his attitude, it was possible that he could be trusted. But trustworthy or not, it was clear only the truth would deter him from killing her. Sunandi took a deep breath, straightened, then made a show of setting her knife on the bed. Lin. Lin looked at her incredulously, but the girl had learned long ago not to question her in front of others. With visible reluctance, she set her knife down as well. At this the youth relaxed somewhat. The gatherer did not. He lowered his hand, however, which Sunandi took for a positive sign. Explain, the gatherer said again. This is not the best place for a discussion, you realize. The royal family's quarters are on the floor directly above. There are no listening holes in this chamber. That would be foolish, since you might find and use them yourself. And her enemies would be far more interested in what she did outside the guest suite anyhow. Very well. Perhaps you're not assassins, or at least not knowingly. The end result is what matters in this case, rather than the intent. Not to us. She resisted the urge to swallow at the menace in his tone. He still intended... No. He still believed wholly in the rightness of killing her. You say that someone named me corrupt. Who? I do not know. Do you know why? What evidence they gave? You were accused of spying, corrupting influential citizens of Gujara, and attempting to foment war. I do not know the evidence given. That was evaluated and accepted by the superior of the Hetwa. Ananja's crusty eyes. For a moment she was tempted to laugh, until she noted the affront on their faces and recalled her careless blasphemy.
Silently she berated herself. Now was not the time for amateurish mistakes. Apologies. I shouldn't be surprised. I have been spying, of course.
Then you acknowledge your corruption.
Spying, as the prince has spied on me, and as the ambassadors of Bromarte, Gijan, Candita, and every other land in spitting distance of the narrow sea have spied on one another for centuries. It is the job of an ambassador to spy. If there's corruption in that, then you'd better gather a few other people in this palace tonight. Do you refute the other charges? His expression was implacable. Corrupting high castes and fomenting war? Let me see. I had a meeting with a high caste who revealed to me one of Gujara's darkest secrets. He did it unbidden and uncoerced, and his intention was to prevent war. How would you judge that, priest of Hananja?
I do not judge.
Then you had better start.
She was growing angry herself in response to the tension of the moment and the gatherer's obstinacy.
There is a reaper in this land, priest, and I have seen the proof of it. I believe you and your brethren know of this abomination and conceal it. The youth frowned in puzzlement. The gatherer went rigid.
There is no reaper in Gujara, he said. There has been none for centuries.
I told you of the corpse I saw.
His jaw worked, and abruptly the affront in his face was eclipsed by something she hadn't expected to see. Shame.
Sometimes gatherers err, he said. Beside him the youth's scowl deepened, though the look he turned on his mentor was somber. The gatherer fixed his eyes on the floor. When that happens, we do penance. But I'm no rogue, nor are any of my brothers. 20 men have died like the corpse I saw at the prison. Do gatherers err so often?
The man was already shaking his head, but in disbelief.
20?
No, that cannot be. Someone would have reported it. One or two mistakes the people can accept, but never so many, so quickly.
They don't know, Lin said suddenly. Sunandi looked down at her in surprise. Lin's pale eyes were narrowed at the gatherer, though she spoke to Sunandi. Someone in the Hedawa probably does, but not these two. Maybe none of the gatherers know. The gatherer looked from one to the other of them, confusion plain on his face. His voice wavered with uncertainty and tension.
There's nothing to know. What you suggest is...
He faltered, silent. Sunandi snorted. At least one of the gatherers knows. Only gatherers become reapers.
There are no reapers in Gujara.
The gatherer's composure shattered so suddenly that it startled them all. He glared at them. Nostrils flared, fists clenched, body trembling with rage. Only his voice remained under control. He had not raised it, though he'd snarled the words with such vehemence that they might as well have been shouted. That would be an abomination beyond imagination. We are tested regularly. When the signs begin to show, we give ourselves to her. We all know our duty. To suggest otherwise is an attack upon the Hedwa itself. The youth looked genuinely alarmed now, and Sunandi felt the same. The sense of unease that she had felt from the beginning redoubled, joined now by an instinctive certainty. Something is wrong with him.
I mean no insult, she said, carefully neutral.
It could be some new poison, whose effects mimic reaping death. Or a plague. There's no way to know for certain. She spread her hands, moving slowly and deliberately, so he could see she meant no harm. But if there's no rogue in the city, then someone certainly means to suggest that there is. Would that not also be an assault upon your brotherhood? The gatherer's agitation cooled somewhat, though his stance remained stiff.
It would if it were true, but you have been judged corrupt. These could be lies. Sunandi could think of no counter for that argument. Abruptly, the whole situation wearied her. She sighed and rubbed her eyes. They could be. For all I know, they are lies fed to me, which I now feed to you. If I had all the answers, my job here would be done. As it is, I'm going to leave it unfinished. I must return to Kisua to tell my people what I've learned so far. She paused, looked at him, realizing that nothing had been settled. If you allow. That quick flex of his jaw muscles again, she saw, above neck cords taut as ropes. After a long silence, however, the gatherer jerked his head in a nod. I declare your tithe in abeyance for now, until I can confirm or disprove what you say. His eyes narrowed to slits. If you have lied, do not think fleeing to Kisua will save you. Gatherers have tracked commissions across the world in the past. Hananja's law outweighs the laws of any foreign land to us. Of that I have no doubt, priest. But how do you intend to discover the truth? I will return to the Hedua and ask my brethren. The man's naivete astonished her. This was a brother of the prince? I would not advise going back to your Hedua. In the morning, when no one finds me dead, the conspirators will know I've told you secrets. The Hedua, this whole city, may no longer be safe for you. He threw her a look of withering contempt. This is not some corruption-steeped barbarian land, woman. He turned to leave. The youth fell in behind him. Wait. He paused, looking back at her warily. She went to her chest, still keeping her movements smooth and slow, and rummaged through it for a moment. If you need to leave the city, give this to the guard at the south gate. Only before sunset, mind you. The shift changes at nightfall. She stepped forward and held out a heavy silver Kisawati coin. One face of it had been scuffed and scored, as if by accident. The gatherer stared down at it in distaste. Bribery. She stifled irritation. A token. The daytime guard at that gate is one of my associates. Show him that and he'll help you. Even tell you where I can be found. I mean to be beyond the walls by morning. He scowled, not touching the coin. She rolled her eyes. If later you decide I have lied, lay it on my breast after you kill me. Do not dare to mock. Exasperation crossed the gatherer's face, and finally he sighed, plucking the coin from her hand. So be it. He turned and walked out of the bedchamber into the darkness of the main room. She saw him appear again as a silhouette against the balcony hangings, the youth a smaller shadow beside him. He vaulted the railing. His protege followed, and both of them were gone. Sunandi let out a long, shaky breath. After an equally long silence, Lin inhaled. I'll go now, she said in Sua. Rising, the girl went to the corner where an open pack sat, half concealed by a large fern. She began rummaging through it, making certain she had everything she needed. Arranged things with our contacts. Should have gone last night, but I wanted to wait until tomorrow, when most of the foreigners began leaving after the Hamyan. She paused, hands stilling their brisk movements for a moment. Thank the gods I delayed. If I hadn't been here. Sunandi nodded, though absently. She hardly felt able to think, much less speak coherently. She'd faced many trials in her years as Kinja's heir, but never a direct threat to her life. The gatherer's eyes glittered in her memory, so dark, so cold, but compassionate, too. That had been the truly terrifying thing. A killer with no malice in his heart. It was unnatural. With nothing in his heart, really, except the absolute conviction that murder could be right and true and holy. Lin took her arm. Sunandi blinked down at her. You need to leave now, Nandi. Yes. Yes. Kinja had taken in Lin because of her quick wit and good sense. Sunandi thanked the gods for both in that moment. I'll see you in Kisua. Lin nodded, flashing one of her impish smiles. Then she was gone, slipping out of the apartment through the front door hanging, an oversized man's robe wrapped around her to conceal the pack. The hall guards would see her and assume she'd just finished some tryst with one of the high-ranking guests. They wouldn't question her as long as she headed toward the servants' quarters. From there, Lin could leave the palace and be out of the city before dawn. Kinja should have made Lin the ambassador, Sunandi decided in momentary envy. She was more ruthless than Sunandi, and eminently better suited to the whole process. But for now, Sunandi would simply be grateful for Kinja's good taste. She sighed, then turned to the chest to dig out her own pack. Behind her, beyond the window, a man's silhouette flickered across the setting moon. Chapter 10 "This magic is abomination," said the protectors to Inanru, when the beast had been run to ground. "We will not permit it within our borders." Thus Inanru went north along the path of the river, and with him went the most devout of his followers. Wisdom. The Reaper knows that it is an abomination. If it had a soul left, it could mourn this. Leaving Yanya Eon had gone smoothly. The palace guards generally concerned themselves far more with unwanted intruders than with departing guests, even those leaving in the small hours of the night. Ehuru summoned another servant-drawn carriage, ordering a drop-off along the quiet streets of the riverfront. Now Najiri sat with his mentor on a rooftop near the river, gazing out at the goddess's blood as it flowed in near the distance. Dreaming Moon had not quite completed her slow, graceful journey across the sky, but already the horizon was growing pale with the coming dawn. Nights were always short for a time after the solstice. Corruption and madness and war. Hamyan and Najiri's conversation with Sister Meliatua had only been the night before. At Najiri's side, Ehuru sat quietly, his eyes fixed on the river, but seeing, Najiri suspected, into some other plane. Though an hour had passed since the conversation with the Kisuwati woman, Ehuru showed no inclination to return to the Hedwa. Nor was there any further sign of the temper that had seized him in the woman's bedchamber, though Najiri knew the calm was only temporary. If Ehuru's control had slipped once, it would slip again. That was the way of the test. He raised his hand, palm up. "Ehuru, brother?" Touch helped a gatherer focus on reality when his other senses began to betray him. It was a trick taught to all who served as Pranjay attendants. Ehuru's eyes flickered back from that other place, shifting to first Najiri's face, and then the proffered hand. Sorrow furrowed his brow, but he sighed and reluctantly took the hand. "Have I frightened you so much, my apprentice?" "You have never frightened me, Ehuru brother." But Ehuru only looked down at their joined hands and sighed again. She wasn't lying. In dreams, I could be sure, but even in waking, there's a sense to such things. Najiri used his free hand to begin stroking the back of Ehuru's. This, too, was permitted in the Pranjay, but Najiri suspected he was not supposed to pay such attention to the smoothness of Ehuru's skin, or the sense of incense and sweat that formed Ehuru's distinctive musk. With an effort, he made himself lean back. "It's possible to lie without lying, brother. She herself admitted that she didn't know the whole truth." "She knows enough to be of concern," Ehuru gazed down at their hands. "But too much of what she said is inconceivable, unacceptable." "This business of a reaper?" Najiri shook his head. "She must have been mistaken. She was, at first. No, Ehuru's expression grew solemn. That mistake was mine. I assumed she spoke of my own error. He hesitated for a long moment. The superior told you? Najiri looked out at the water. Of course. I made the choice to have you as my mentor in full knowledge. What did he tell you? That you failed to fulfill a commission, doing harm to the soul, and perhaps even destroying it. Ehuru frowned as he spoke, however, and Najiri stopped speaking, concerned. Was there more to the matter, then? Ehuru took a deep breath, seeming to ready himself. The tithe was to be taken from a foreigner, a man of the Bromarte. I found him already in Inakarek and followed him in. Ehuru abruptly went silent. His fingers twitched a little against Najiri's. Brother? There was corruption in his soul. Ehuru still gazed out at the river. But Najiri suspected he did not see the palm trees on the far shore, the reeds waving in the wind, or the flatboats bobbing gently at their moorings. His hand in Najiri's felt cold. Not enough to make him criminal, but enough to taint his dreamscape with ugliness and violence. I tried to take him to a more pleasant place, but then he had a true seeing. Najiri frowned. Foreigners don't see truly in their dreams, brother. They wander helpless in Inakarek every night. A four-flood child has more control. Foreigners have the same innate abilities as we of Gujara, Najiri. Anything a skilled narcomancer can do, they can, though only by accident. Najiri held back a snort. The notion of a barbarian managing the same feat as the most highly trained sisters, sharers, and gatherers seemed ludicrous. Did children write treatises? In this Bromarte's case, Ehuru sighed, up to that point, he had been no different from any other stubborn, frightened dreamer. But then he said to me, "They're using you." Najiri frowned. What did that mean? I don't know. But I felt the truth of his words. And tonight, when the Kisawati woman said the same thing. So that was it. Najiri squeezed his hand. She is corrupt, brother. A professional liar by her own admission. Then you dismiss her tales of dead prisoners, and a conspiracy to begin a war. Dead prisoners would hardly begin a war. And anyhow, every account that I have read of war speaks of its terrible destruction and suffering. No one would start such a thing deliberately. Ehuru glanced at him, and Najiri was startled to see a smile on his mentor's face. Ehuru, brother? It's nothing. Just that I forget your youth at times. Ehuru drew up his knees and wrapped his arms about them, gazing up into the sky. Tiny, pale, waking moon peeked timidly out from behind her greater sister's curve. Sunrise would come soon. I envy you, that youth. Najiri gazed at Ehuru in surprise, and read faint lines of regret and worry in his mentor's profile. You believe the woman's tale. Ehuru sighed into a breeze. When the Bromarte had his true seeing, I mishandled the dream out of surprise. But after he was dead, I saw something else. A man, I think, on the rooftop across. He was wrong, Najiri. I can't explain it. His movements, his shape, the feel of his presence. I have never been so frightened in my life. Najiri shifted uncomfortably. A vision. A manifestation of your guilt. He had heard that strong narcomancers were sometimes plagued by such things. The dreaming gift was not always easy to control. Flush with dream blood. No. The dream blood was rotten. I was sick with it. Not enraptured. What I saw was real. The Kisawati's Reaper? I can think of nothing else that would have sent such dread through my heart. But to become a Reaper, A user of dream magic must fail the Pranjay, refuse the final tithe, go ungathered by our brethren for 4 days, somehow remain unnoticed by others while he goes slowly mad. He shook his head, unwilling to believe. It's impossible. Our brothers are too wise and faithful to let such a thing happen. I imagine those long-ago reapers had faithful brothers, too, once. Najiri sucked in his breath and stared at Ehuru. Ehuru smiled bleakly, his eyes lost in the distance. The words settled into Najiri's heart like stones, and he fell silent beneath their weight. Perhaps out of respect for Najiri's turmoil, Ehuru stopped talking as well, and they both brooded for a while. Eventually, though, Ehuru sighed. I saw what I saw, Najiri. And if there are 20 dead men who saw the same thing, well, that's for the superior to determine. Najiri got to his feet and brushed off his loin drape decisively. Ehuru glanced up at him, a look of mild surprise on his face. We must return to the Hetawa and report this, and you must go to the sharers to request an infusion. Ehuru raised an eyebrow. One display of ill-temper does not make me out of control. Not alone, but there have been other signs, haven't there? It was unseemly to speak of such things, except when they had to be said. Ehuru squared his shoulders, radiating stubbornness. Najiri pressed on. I was trained, brother, though I never got the chance to properly serve. Have you seen more visions than usual? Have there been times when your hand shook? Ehuru lifted a hand and gazed at it. The morning of the Hamyan? He'd let himself suffer for 2 whole days? Najiri scowled. Then it must be done. You gathered no tithe tonight. By tomorrow night you might be hearing voices, seeing enemies under every leaf. Ehuru got to his feet and faced him. I believe I know my own pattern, Najiri, having experienced it every year for the past 20. It was a mild rebuke as such things went, but it silenced Najiri anyhow. He bowed his head, fists clenched in shame and anger at being reminded of his place. But a moment later Ehuru sighed and put a hand on his shoulder. I'll go to the sharers if that will ease your fears, he said, and then we'll both go to the superior. He paused then, cocking his head. Najiri frowned and opened his mouth to ask what was the matter, but before he could speak, Ehuru held up a hand to shush him. He pivoted slowly toward the north, squinting along the flow of the river. The rooftops had become still as the dreamer's fat curve at last sank out of sight, leaving only the deep monochrome darkness cast by waking moon's pallid light. No birds sang. Not even a breeze stirred the laundry-heavy clotheslines. The city was silent. No, not silent. A few blocks away, echoing up from the street, Najiri heard the slap of sandals on stone. Running. Light, Ehuru whispered. A woman, perhaps. Or a child. Najiri swung about to orient on those running feet as well, tensing as 1,000 possibilities, most of them dire, ran through his mind. A messenger, a servant on an errand, a rapist, a murderer. They fell silent again, listening. The rhythm of the runner changed, skidding now and again, faltering and then resuming. Najiri frowned, for there was something indisputably urgent about the sound of those running feet, something frantic. Ehuru lifted a hand in a quick signal, follow in silence. Najiri obeyed at once as Ehuru abruptly set off, leaping from the roof on which they stood to the next, and then running along another. Their course, Najiri realized as he ran behind his mentor, would intersect that of the runner in 1/2 block or so. Ehuru stopped at the edge of a squat storage house's roof, peering over its wall into the street below. No one was in sight. The patter of feet had stopped. From an alley on the other side of the building, the direction in which they'd last heard the runner, they both heard a sharp, frightened cry. Ehuru was moving before the cry's echo faded. Running with no further attempt at stealth, Najiri scrambled to keep up. Even after 10 years of acrobatics training, it still shocked him when Ehuru reached the roof edge and slowed not one whit before leaping off. He flipped in the air, his hands reaching back to catch the wall as he fell, his feet braced against the stone to cushion the impact. An instant later he let go, dropping another man-length to land on fingers and toes, his eyes fixed on the dark beyond the alley's entrance. From that darkness came a soft hiss. Najiri skidded to a halt on the rooftop, his heart pounding. There was no easier way down. Swallowing, he took a deep breath to focus as the sentinels had taught him, and concentrated on the opposite wall of the alley as he repeated Ehuru's flipping trick. He fouled the final leap, however, landing without injury, but stumbling. Before Najiri could regain his balance, something flew out of the dark and struck Ehuru. It looked like a badly packed sack of clothes. It had yellow hair. The Kisawati woman's girl. Ananja, have mercy! Ehuru grunted as he was borne down by the dead weight of the corpse. As he struggled to extricate himself from flopping limbs and a lolling head and horrible, horrible sightless eyes, Najiri moved to help, and gasped as something else came out of the dark and struck him so hard that his vision went white. He hit the cobblestones with painful force, too stunned to do more than flail weakly at the thing that had struck him. But this thing was no corpse. "Pretty child," whispered a voice in Najiri's ear. Fear froze him. The voice seemed barely human, low and rough. "I will enjoy your taste." Hands as strong as iron caught Najiri's arms. One of them pinned his wrists above his head. The other, smelling of dirt and bile and a four of other foul things, fumbled over his face. Najiri shut his eyes in reflex as fingertips pressed against his eyelids. "Wait, this is..." But just as he understood, he woke, screaming, somehow freed. Terror pounded through his blood so powerfully that he rolled to his side and vomited a thin, sour trickle, then could not find the wit to move away from the mess. Instinctively, he curled himself into a ball, praying for the fear to pass and for the sick throb of his head to either go away or kill him and be done with it. Dimly, he heard the sounds of flesh striking flesh, the scuffle of sandals on stone, a feral snarl like that of a jackal. "Abomination!" Ehuru's shout came to Najiri through his misery, and some of the fear faded. Ehuru would keep him safe. "You shall not have him!" A rough laugh was the creature's reply, and Najiri whimpered, for somehow he had heard that laugh in his nightmares, but he could not remember the nightmares. The cobblestones vibrated as feet pounded over them, out of the alleyway, running away. Then hands lifted Najiri, cradling him against warmth and muscle and a hard-beating heart. "Najiri, open your eyes." It had not occurred to Najiri that his eyes were closed. Then fingers touched Najiri's eyelids. He thrashed and opened his mouth to scream, terrified. But something sweet and warm and exquisite brushed against his mind, soft as flower petals, soothing away the terror. When Najiri opened his eyes, Ehuru's worried expression brought reality back to him, though in fragments. "Thank the dreamer. I thought your soul had come completely untethered." The world shifted dizzyingly as Ehuru lifted Najiri in his arms. "The sharers will be able to heal you fully." Then the world began to bob and wheel in a mad dance as Ehuru ran with him. Najiri's last sight before unconsciousness
was the gem-layered glow of dawn. Chapter 11.